Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome back to the Salieri Report Joel Garbon, who has joined us once before. He is has had a long and very successful career as an industrial science consultant and educator. But in addition to a successful career and raising and having and heading up a family, he also decided that he would write a wonderful book on breakthrough energy with Gene Manning, so co-authored, and become president of the New Energy Movement. I always wonder where he gets the time to do anything. There's some other things he does. I won't even go into those. But anyway, so we're talking to a very accomplished person, and there's no one I trust more to help me navigate the topic of breakthrough energy. So, Joel, welcome back to the Salieri Report. We really appreciate you taking time from a very busy schedule to do this.
Well, thanks, Catherine. And you forgot to mention that we always have a lot of fun and we have hearty laughter when we have...
Yes, we and we get an opportunity. We go to conferences together and we get to roll our eyes a lot.
There's a lot of great topics that we get to touch on here. It's always a treat. And thank you so much for inviting me on.
Well, I just said to you before we did this that when you change the energy model, you change the entire economic and investment model of the planet. So, this kind of topic can lead to anything. But let's just get back to the beginning, and I want to get your help to explain some of what we mean by breakthrough energy technology. What is breakthrough energy? And break it down for us, both what is it and what are the sort of different areas we need to understand if we're going to get a basic framework of the topic?
Well, generally speaking, when we talk about breakthrough energy technologies, we're talking about genres of technology that go beyond the conventional renewables. So we all know that what we've been using primarily for the last several hundred years have been fossil fuels. We've been burning stuff, primarily hydrocarbons or wood or other types of biomass. And then we've been burning more natural gas lately. And, then we've gone into this clean energy revolution that is using more wind and solar and a little bit of tidal power, and we've been using hydroelectric power for a long time. But even those, what we call the conventional renewable power sources, really are, they're incremental technology improvements on technologies that have existed for a long time. So there's been windmills around for many, many centuries. Hydropower has been used probably for over 1,000 years. And solar in its various forms as well. But when we're talking about breakthrough energy technologies, what we're really talking about are leading edge, call them frontier physics, types of energy generating technologies that have not existed before and that really need a major upstep in awareness from not just the science community, but also from the public. And they need support. They need funding support. They need a lot of advocacy because many of those who are coming up with these technologies are sequestered away in labs and private workspaces, oftentimes working alone as isolated inventors. And we really need advocates for these people to help get their breakthroughs out into the public domain so they can have a social benefit.
One of the things I want to address right up front is we posted on the blog post for the Salieri Report a copy of your description of initiative I'm very excited about, which is standards. I named my last company after Alexander Hamilton, and Hamilton was instrumental in getting the Bureau of Standards created at the Department of Treasury, which was critical to the sort of industrial economy or the development of the industrial economy in the United States. And having dipped into dealing with a couple of inventors in this area, I think having standards to allow people to test and verify is, you know, that can be agreed upon and has real support is very important. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about that, because I think that's one of the steps that's going to make a lot of this, the development in this area, financially feasible.
Okay, so what's the deal with why we even need any type of standardized tests and test protocols for breakthrough energy technology? I'm going to use as a good example what has been called cold fusion. Many people, if not, you know, most educated people have heard of this. Cold fusion is a technology we can talk about a little bit later as far as what it actually is scientifically.
Oh no, let's talk about it now.
You want to talk about it?
I keep reading and trying. No, that's okay. I won't let you get lost. Right. I keep trying to understand cold fusion and I can't do it.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll use this basically starting from its description and how it came about and what's happened since then and why test standards have a real application here. So, all right, 1989. We go back to March 1989, almost 26 years ago. There was an announcement by two electrochemists from University of Utah by the names of Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons of a new process that they had come up with for generating energy, thermal energy, heat. And what this process basically involved was doing a simple electrolysis experiment where you had electrodes in some water, but in this case it was water that had been enriched with deuterium, which is also called heavy water, and running a current through that system, through the electrodes, resulted in, after some period of time, the release of an excess amount of heat that could not be accounted for just by the electrical input that was going into the process. And that discovery of this anomalous excess amount of heat was very exciting to the researchers. And ultimately, they made a press release that sent a shockwave across the world, really, in scientific circles and in the public's imagination, because essentially they'd said, look, we've discovered something that could result in the end of fossil fuels, a radical new energy source that should be clean and cheap. It's essentially using water as a fuel and should be something that could somehow be scaled up to be a practical power source. Well, these guys, Fleischmann and Pons, they were just jumped on immediately by the scientific community, especially by those who were involved in conventional nuclear physics, and the nuclear physicists essentially were, I think, feeling a lot of encroachment upon their scientific turf by these upshot electrochemists, like, what are you guys doing talking about nuclear chemistry? But the long and short of it was that the research findings themselves came under a lot of scrutiny and criticism by many in the conventional mainstream academic circles. And they beat their drumbeat so loud that essentially Fleischmann and Pons were, basically were blackballed from the academic science community. And it was a very, very sad state of affairs because these pronouncements of cold fusion as essentially junk science were made prematurely. And there were apparently a number of vested interests who were at the forefront of that drumbeat to basically sweep this cold fusion nonsense under the rug. And, you know, part of this is going to the test standards angle. Fleischmann and Pons released their announcement of this radical new energy science with relatively little data and with essentially little, if any, replication data or independent verification of the process. And even though there have been many researchers that quickly studied the findings, studied the experiments, and set up in their own labs to try to replicate the process, and many with finding the same type of anomalous excess energy results. There was a lot of disagreement in the science community about what constituted a valid proof that there truly was excess heat being generated. And so that debate raged long and hard for many years, in fact, right up to this very day, even though we were, 26 years later after that announcement. So we've got all of these researchers around the world, and there have been dozens and dozens, including researchers at our own U.S. Naval Laboratories, MIT, many universities, Texas A&M, researchers in Italy, Japan, on and on. I mean, all throughout the globe, been dozens and dozens of very credible, credentialed scientists who've come up with good findings. Actually, findings that are much more robust than Fleshman and Pond's original findings. But yet, still, the debate rages about what's the best way to measure the heat output or any electrical output, and it's still a very contentious field. So there definitely is a need to have some agreed upon standardized testing protocols that an inventor or research team can apply to their breakthrough energy process or invention that would stand the stamp of a verification or a proof, such that if they do abide by those standardized test protocols and they do indeed show valid results, that this would now be an investment-worthy concept or invention. And that's where, we've been trying at New Energy Movement, my organization, in collaboration with some other colleagues and other interested parties, to help assemble support for a standardized testing protocol document, an actual document that could be put into the public domain that inventors and researchers could use, and knowing that this was put together by credentialed scientists and engineers, it's something that would stand the test of time, that was using the appropriate instrumentation, using the appropriate methodologies, and that this would be a way for the inventor to say, okay, I know if I do it like this and I show results that are such, I know I've got something of very, very high interest to the world and something that's marketable.
It can be verified by a third party.
Exactly.
Right.
Because the third party would use these same test protocols to verify
right.
the findings of the inventor or the research team who also used those protocols.
Right. It's very, to me, this kind of thing is absolutely essential. Before we dive into the different areas, which I want to do, I just want to step back to the second law of thermodynamics. Because what we're basically talking about when we talk about breakthrough energy is whether or not the second law of thermodynamics is essentially universally true. Is that not
the
gist of it?
Yes, that's waved around as a, some would stand behind it as like a barrier to new discovery. And what I mean by that is, our understandings of science, while we may consider them to be very advanced, is that's a very relative position to have. If we were to look back at the researchers in the time of Galileo, there's no doubt that they would just be amazed at how far science had come on our planet. But if we were to have someone come from a culture perhaps outside our solar system that knew how to traverse interstellar distances with advanced propulsion and energy technologies, and they arrive on little planet Earth, they would probably think that our science was relatively crude And they would think that our scientists would be arrogant to hold the position that, well, we essentially know all of the universal principles of physics. So, you know, whenever we talk about any particular theory as being dogma, to me, that it really doesn't smack of good science, because good science should be open to new understandings and especially to new data. I mean, if someone has data to present, the scientist has to at least be willing to look at it. Now, you know, our current understandings of thermodynamics, you know, and everyone hears about the, you know, laws of conservation of matter and energy and such, and derivatives from that. Okay, that's well and good. But none of these inventors who are claiming that they've uncovered a process that produces the appearance of excess energy, they are not claiming that they are actually creating energy. Essentially, what they're saying is that, hey, we may be transforming energy from one form to another, and it may be that the form that's coming into the process is a form of energy that's not easily measured or isn't so detectable by our current instrumentation or by our current understandings. And a good example of that would be when people hear about zero-point energy. Well, what is zero-point energy? What is that? You know, some will describe it in very esoteric terms. Well, it's the etheric material that's, you know, it's the background fabric of space-time and all these kind of, you know, I don't know, kind of otherworldly
descriptions. Mystical descriptions.
Yeah, mystical. And you know what? And some of that may be the most appropriate way to describe this stuff that seemingly pervades everywhere in space. Hard to measure, but yet we know it's there because, you know, physics accepts that zero-point energy is real. It's just hard to really know how to wrap our minds around it because it seems like it's so thin, but at the same time, so dense that a whole universe could be born from a tiny, tiny point of energy. And so it's a very, very tough thing for us to get our heads wrapped around. But still, it's a great example of something that could be a source of energy that we're not good at measuring or even describing. We could be tapping into that in some of these exotic energy processes and converting them into forms of energy that are very easy for us to measure, like heat, like light, like electricity, other forms of radiation. So, you know, no one's claiming that they're creating energy. They are saying, look, we're finding a novel way to transform it into a type that's useful to us.
See, I see it as simple politics and risk management, not science. So I think the second law of thermodynamics is basically designed to ensure that you can enforce central control and you can make sure that a very large population doesn't have access to technology that could be, you know, create risk of a variety of kinds. So it's really a law that keeps you in a model that keeps the sort of current system working and operating. And if the law isn't true, well, then, you know, it blows the model.
Oh, it's very inconvenient, right? for the model to be untrue.
Right.
Or even to just be a little sideways. And, you know, science itself is very politically loaded.
Unbelievable.
Politically loaded. And it's interesting. I've worked in industrial science for over 30 years. I'm not a PhD, but I am a scientist. However, many who are PhDs think, well, you're not a scientist unless you have that degree. However, I have seen many who really don't have a good understanding of how things practically work. They may have an understanding of some things that happen experimentally in very small, conditioned surroundings in a lab, but they really can't see how these things work together to actually build a process that actually does something useful to society. Like it makes paper, or it cleans water, or it makes fuel, or something like this that we all take for granted.
Right.
I think that there's something to be said for having a lot of practical experience, maybe a little bit of a broad wisdom in some of these things, and get out of the lab. You know, it's not degrees do not make one's value. And unfortunately, in the academic science community, often there's a lot of hiding behind academic terminology and whose career is getting advanced by publishing this paper or that paper, and all of these things, and they lose touch with what's really going on in the real world. And it's unfortunate. And the structure of academic science and the funding that goes along with it encourages that entrenchment of thinking that results in a lot of dogmatic positions and results in the refusal often to look at disruptive data because it upsets the gravy train of funding coming to someone
right.
who's working along conventional terms. So there.
Well, let's face it, Nikola Tesla did not have a chair at Harvard.
No, he did not.
And if he tried to get one, J.P. Morgan would have made sure he couldn't.
But I hear he wore really nice white silken gloves at dinner.
Yes.
It was quite the charmer.
Yes. Okay, so let's dive through the areas. When I was trying to organize my notes on this, I was thinking in terms of energy that serves resident. I was thinking in applications, residential and commercial real estate or transportation. I keep looking at what's going on with cars. And then sort of industrial equipment and manufacturing process. And then I looked at your standards, and you've got them organized more around the technology. So maybe if you could explain the list that you had.
Okay. So as far as developing some standardized testing protocols, it's practical to categorize these as far as the forms of input and output energy that might be present in any type of breakthrough invention. Okay, so if you use, for instance, let's say cold fusion, like we just talked about. Okay, so in cold fusion, what do you have? You have a chemical present, it's water. You also have a chemical present that's in the form of the electrodes there. In cold fusion, they were focusing on these palladium cathodes, and then there was another material for the anode in the electrolysis experiment. So already we got chemicals present, we have electrical input present, and then what is of most interest on the output side of the experiment is heat. So there's a thermal effect, there's thermal energy there, and potentially there is some type of radiation effect, perhaps a nuclear effect. It's called cold fusion, which implies that there's something happening on the nuclear level. So there may be some things related to nuclear energy that we should take into account. If we looked at other types of technologies that might use, let's say, permanent magnets as part of the platform for a technology, maybe like a magnetic motor or something like that. Okay, so now we would have electricity involved because we got a motor. We have magnetism as an effect. So these might be a couple of the inputs there. And now we might have, it being a motor, one of the output energy forms is mechanical power, where you're actually turning something, you're moving something, or cranking something. So there's mechanical measurements required. You might have electricity on there if it's coupled up to a generator, or maybe there's some other type of field effects that happen around such a device. Perhaps it causes the air temperature actually to drop, which is often an interesting anomaly that happens with some of these devices. Rather than it heating up, it actually
With magnetic devices?
Yes, with magnetic devices, yeah. This often happens. And so, you know, so there's something else that's going on. Other types of devices produce various types of plasma discharges. So being able to measure those wavelengths of light.
Okay, so step back. Ignorant people here, explain what plasma is.
Okay, well, plasma, and quite simply, is generating a hot ionized gas. That's the simplest way to think about it. And so anyone who's looked at a neon sign, all right, what's causing that glow, that pinkish or greenish or yellow, you pick the color. All right, what's going on in there? It's not like you have with a normal incandescent light bulb, which is the kind that, you know, we typically, for years and years, we use the Edison light bulb where it had a little filament, you know, in there. Okay, in an incandescent light bulb, you actually have current going through that little filament, and that current is heating up that wire and is generating light. But in a neon sign or in a fluorescent bulb, what you have is you have a gas in there that under the presence of high voltage, but not necessarily, you know, anything that's conductive, and that you don't have a wire that's going across the ends, both ends of the bulb, but you have a high voltage, and what that does is it induces the ionization of the gas inside the bulb. And that excites the gas, puts it into a higher energy state, and then it releases photons of light. And in certain, depending on the gas, it's going to be a different color. The gas mixture that's in a normal fluorescent bulb is such that it generates what we would generally think of as kind of a whitish light. But in a neon sign, it's going to be different gases chosen to produce the more, you know, artful, colorful type of effects that we want. So a plasma generally is a hot ionized gas. That's probably the simplest way to think about it.
And so nuclear, what would fit under the discussion of nuclear?
Well, for nuclear, again, when most people think of nuclear, they think of two things. They think of bombs and they think of nuclear power plants, and they associate radiation. Like, okay, what about this Fukushima thing? What about this Chernobyl thing? What's that all about? Well, nuclear power itself generally can come in two different forms. It can either be from a fission process where relatively heavy elements split apart into lighter elements, and in that process they release a lot of energy in the form of light and heat and some type of radioactivity, some radiation. Or a nuclear energy process can be what's called a fusion reaction, where light elements come together to form heavier elements and likewise produce a lot of heat and light. So if you look up in the sky in the daytime and you see that brilliant star there that we call our sun, that's using a fusion process. It's generally fusing together very light atoms of hydrogen into helium. That's the primary fusion reaction in a star like our sun. And of course, it's so energetic that it's enough to power a whole solar system. In a conventional power plant here on Earth, we're using heavy elements in a fission reaction, where we're taking something like uranium or plutonium, splitting those atoms apart and releasing energy, desirably in the form of heat. And that heat then is used to boil water, to turn a turbine, and to generate electricity. So it's basically a glorified way of boiling water to make steam, rather than using, let's say, oil or gas or coal or wood, to heat a boiler. We're using nuclear power to do that. And unfortunately, in the fission type of power that we've, you know, used for decades in our nuclear power plants, those do tend to generate a lot of high-level radioactive waste that's very dangerous, very toxic, and long-lived. And it's a real problem legacy for us. And now we've got something like Fukushima that's just been an unmitigated disaster.
I was just in the process of preparing, I was revisiting what thorium technology was. And so this is a little bit outside of, this is back into conventional. But what I hadn't realized was how far we'd gone with thorium technology and the extent to which both the the powers that be really put the kibosh on it. And we could have globally had much safer nuclear technology, and instead we chose much more dangerous.
Well, that's true. And, you know, when people hear, you know, thorium, you know, again, it's like, well, what's that? You know, that's some element off the periodic table. Well, it's not exactly something that you're looking at in your kitchen all the time here. So a brief description of a thorium energy process. It's basically, thorium is a fairly common element, a heavier element, that can be used to derive a certain isotope of uranium. And then this particular isotope of uranium, it's uranium-233, that can then undergo a much safer fission process than what occurs in our conventional nuclear power plants that uses uranium-235. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot of difference. You know, who cares about uranium-233 versus 235? Well, the difference is this. Uranium-235 is what basically is used for weapons-grade nuclear material. It's what you can make an atom bomb out of that stuff. And the products of fission of that material are more radioactive. The uranium-233, it's a safer process. It's generally not considered weapons-grade material, so the nuclear proliferation issue isn't quite as significant with that. And the thorium is much more abundant than uranium is naturally, and you can derive the uranium-233 from thorium. So this process has been well researched. There's many nations that have been doing this research for quite a long time, looking at it. But again, there's a political process and other vested interests, including military interests. And if you look in, you know, in the United States, I mean, the Department of Energy, and the Pentagon, they have heavy hands into what goes on with nuclear policy for obvious reasons, because of the weapon, issue with that whole thing. So it's a hot potato. And it's fair to say that the public at large has become quite sensitized to the whole issue of nuclear power of any sort because of accidents like Chernobyl and like Fukushima. And I would say that's a good thing that's happened, that for people to stand up and pay attention to what's going on with energy policy, not just nuclear policy, but our whole energy policy, because it's not just about flipping the switch on your wall and getting electricity or pushing your toaster down and getting some heat to cook the bread. It shouldn't be mindless like that. We really should be more aware as citizens of where these power sources are coming from, and what the implications are for our environment, for our health, for our national security, and for the lifetime effects of our choices in energy sources. And so when something like Fukushima happens, hopefully it wakes up people to go, oh, wait, that was not good. Now what do we do? What do we do to fix it? And what do we do to prevent it from happening somewhere else? Because we are highly, highly vulnerable to this happening again somewhere else, including on our own shores.
Right. Now, are there any more technologies you want to describe?
Well, there are some other ones here that I would say are other forms of using water as fuel. Some people who may like go on to, YouTube, and if you just put in, water as fuel and you look through YouTube, you'll find hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of videos of various inventors of all sorts, you know, who've claimed to find the holy grail as far as using water as a fuel. And in general, there are some very interesting processes that can break down water into a combustible gas, and generally some mixture of hydrogen and some other components, you know, water being hydrogen and oxygen, and when you used various processes to break it down, whether it's just simple electrolysis or some type of pulsed frequency, you can get some very interesting gaseous products that can be then burnt or recombined in other ways to liberate either mechanical power or heat or electricity.
So the notion of running cars on water is not completely impossible.
It's very real. It's very real. I've seen some experiments that were very eye popping. Some of them even done in my own kitchen by inventors who demonstrated actual burning of water. And I mean where water, like right out of the tap, it was on fire. So this is definitely possible. And there's novel circuitries involved. Special type of plasma sparks that are involved to do this type of water ignition process. But it is out there. Now having it be brought to the point where it's safe and practical and accepted, and can get past the hurdles of certain vested interests that have erected various barriers to the disruption of the typical automotive fuels. This is something that I think has great promise. And there's other applications of water and other water fuel type of technologies that we won't go into here, but it has great promise.
So let me just say, Joel, let's step back. You have, as a scientist for many years, observed lots of claims and lots of different technology.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to say that you believe technology exists which can create greater or sort of more economic energy than the systems we're using now.
Oh, yes. I think that would be not only technologies with the ability to help clean up the environment, to start a whole nother level of economic prosperity and shared abundance, but could help us to remediate problems that we already have in the environment. There's so much damage that's been done that is just, in a way, it's just sitting there. It's just kind of festering sores all over the planet that are fairly large-scale projects that require cleanup and remediation, but the cost in conventional energy to address those is enormous. To have new sources of energy that are very, very inexpensive and that are non-polluting would give us the ability to help clean up the nest to a tremendous degree. And that's one of the things that really excites me. Some of us hear about, they hear about this giant patch of plastic debris floating around somewhere out there in the Pacific that some say it's somewhere between the size of the state of Texas and the size of the country of Australia, but it's enormous and it's just kind of swirling around out there, this wasteland of trash. Well, if you had free energy, essentially free energy, and I'm using that term loosely, but very low cost energy that was clean, we'd have the ability to deploy certain types of operations that could literally clean that stuff up. I mean, like, go get it and harvest it. And that would be just kind of like one type of big picture thing that would be really cool to do. We could do all.
We could have happiness breaking out all over. I don't think there's anything that depresses humans more than seeing the environmental damage to the planet.
Right,
I think that's
right.
Just a terrible emotional burden for every person on this planet, whether we're conscious of it or not.
Ultimately, though, Catherine, I think that from just the way we live our lives. People right now, to a large degree, can feel very constrained by the work that they do, that they're required to do just to support their family. Much of that has to do with energy, the cost of energy,
right,
and how we go about things. If we truly had free energy or nearly free energy, we'd be able to have a whole different type of societal structuring that would unchain people to a large degree from the ways we've been earning livings, going about, you know, our normal life, and be able to tap into a lot more of our creative potential to come up with new and more brilliant, more beautiful ways of living this life here, you know, just individually and collectively. And so I think we have so much untapped goodness and potential for just amazing transformations. And
it's interesting when you sit and you watch this technology, you know, I haven't seen anywhere near what you have, but when I watch it, Stuart's thing, you just start to giggle, you know, because it makes you realize how abundant things could be. And it's funny, you know, when I, in the 90s, when I was prototyping, sort of doing, sort of re-engineering the financial system in a way that would re-optimize, and I walked away from that realizing, you know, the current wealth is only 1% of what it could be, was my estimation. And that was before I knew about breakthrough energy. And then when you add breakthrough energy to that, it's kind of like, you know, well, who needs to worry about money?
Right. Well, see, there you go.
Yeah.
It's just
there you go.
Just like that. If you had access to unlimited energy, you really now have the tools in hand to provide for your material support, whether it's your food, whether it's your lighting, your heating, whether it's transportation, construction, all these things you have now as a tool that you, your family, your community can use, and you don't have to buy into this whole large matrix of complexity and all these little economic twists and turns that just so many people, I think, just
so let me speak on behalf of Mr. Global. Okay, let me pretend for a second I'm Mr. Global, and let me argue why, you know, I don't want to let the genie out of the bottle. Okay, I don't want to open Pandora's box.
To stuff them back in. I'm jumping up.
So the first thing I would say is, look, we already have too many people on this planet. If you make energy free, the population's going to explode, and then we're really going to have an environmental mess. That's the first thing he's going to say.
Mm-hmm. I was
okay. Then the second thing he's going to say is, you know, you give this technology into the hands of people, you know, just 7 billion people, and some of them are going to use it to do harm. It's too powerful. They're going to use it to do harm, and we're going to get an even more dangerous mess. And then the third thing they're going to say is, you know, there's only 300 million of Americans. There are only 500, you know, million of English-speaking people. And if we left free energy out of the bag when it's all over, the Chinese will control and run all of us. And we don't want that. We're a minority, so we have to do what we you know, we need a control model so the minority can stay in control. That's what they're going to say.
Yeah, sure. I can understand that. And you know what the underlying basis of all that is, of course. It's fear. It's fear,
right.
It's fear. You can call it other things. You can call it, you know, greed or selfishness or paranoia or a superiority complex, whatever you want. But no, it's all fear. It's all fear.
Well, let me bring up a sub let me unpack a piece of that. Right now the US currency is operating on an oil standard, essentially. And, you know, if you let out free energy, then you need another collateral basis for the currency. And I've always believed the whole push to get the whole world on GMO seed was, you know, they were looking for something that would work after energy, you know, after oil and gas wouldn't do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always assumed that was in anticipation of this technology, you know, of the genie coming out of the bottle and not being able to be put back in. But you know, when you change the model, you know, you have to reinvent the currency. You have to reinvent a lot of things. Now, I'm not I'm not agreeing with Mr. Global, but I'm just saying Mr. Global is afraid of a whole bunch of different things. And if you look at the reasons why Mr. Global is afraid, you know, historically there are good reasons to be afraid. There's a reason he's afraid of the human race.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, Mr. Global is so entrenched in a separation mentality and is so disconnected from the source of life that it will not end well for, you know, the Mr. Global legacy. Mr. Global could be a hero for the planet, which I could guarantee would be much more satisfying than being looked at as a devil. And
right. So the question is how to...
Yeah. Go ahead.
You go.
Well, an empire is never going to stand. It's not going to stand.
I agree.
The only thing that's going to stand is a society that becomes increasingly enlightened and increasingly not only in greater harmony with the other human elements of the society, but aligned with life in the way life works. You know, life is abundant. Life shares aspects of life, and it shares it freely. Life partakes of free air, of free sunshine, of free water. There's biblical sayings that are so beautiful about, you know, the flowers and the birds who have no care because they're provided for and they partake of this universal abundance. They don't have a separation mentality. They don't mind that the bees are collecting pollen and drinking nectar from the same flowers that the hummingbirds are. They don't mind that because they recognize that without those bees, there'd be no flowers. And so they work in harmony. And we unfortunately...
Right, the sun never said to a forest, look, you can only have sunshine if you allow me to put in a chip. You know, you see how ridiculous it is.
You're going to coax me into photovoltaic solar panels and that here. I'm not going there because that's conventional renewable, and that's you can have someone else talk about that.
Well, one thing I did bring up, and I sent you my notes, is I do see, you know, there's a lot of non-energy technology that I think is impacting energy usage right now. Because if you look at the revolution in smartphones, I mean, we're getting close to having everybody on the planet in direct contact with each other. But I also think material sciences, I sent you the link from the announcement from the Swiss that they had used graphene to get the efficiency on solar panels up to 60%, which is really, you know, that knocks your socks off. Then you're talking about really competing against coal, although I don't know how expensive a graphene solar panel it might get. You know, graphene is still pretty expensive.
Let's put it this way. It'd be, at least right now, it'd be like, you know, someone who can only afford a bicycle looking at the Tesla through the auto show window, you know, with
right.
drooling. That's right. About the relative, distance that
right.
that a graphene solar panel would be in affordability. And really, I mean, that particular development that the Swiss announced, it's still very much in its micro stages, in its infancy. Graphene is an amazing material. It has very unique and anomalous
right.
characteristics and great promise, but it's going to take quite some time before that becomes a practical solution. So 60%. Photovoltaic efficiency at some point, yeah, that's great. Right now, you know, there have been a lot of great strides made even in like the last several years, and now we're
hoping. Oh, I think so, yeah.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
So solar's come a long way. In fact, even today, Apple announced an $850 million deal with the solar.
First solar,
you know, to collaborate on a big new solar farm. And, and Amazon's powering all of their data centers with renewable energy of some sort now. And that's all well and good.
No, right. Isn't some of that marketing, though?
We're talking about. What's that?
Yeah, that's kind of, I think of a lot of that is marketing.
Oh, sure,
because,
sure it is.
You know, sure it is. I posted the link to the Department of Energy renewable data book that they just published in December. Mm-hmm. And, you know, solar is such a tiny part of both the domestic and global energy picture. It's just tiny.
Right.
So even if you...
It's waved around a lot, yeah.
Right, it is waved around a lot. And, of course, people relate to it. They can understand it.
Yeah, people should... what they need to understand is that we have such a tremendous baseload energy demand that is largely, almost all of it, is fossil and nuclear-based.
Right.
That's this huge baseload demand. And where the renewables have come into play, primarily wind and solar, have been in meeting a small percentage of incremental demand that has come
right
on top of this huge baseload. Now it is true that these conventional renewables of wind and solar have been growing in the increment that they are able to satisfy of this growing demand each year, but they're still not the dominant part of that. There's more, you know, natural gas power plants. There's much more of those that go on. You know, the Chinese are still building a lot more coal powered plants, as India is, and all this. So there's still a lot more growth in the hydrocarbon based power sources than there is on the wind and the solar, even though wind and solar have been growing leaps
right
and bounds, but relative to their own base, but it's not so great relative to the whole baseload demand. So,
all right. Well, one of the technologies I named in my email in the blog post I wrote in anticipation of this discussion was fracking technology, which is clearly, yeah, is just another. It's a technology to improve accessibility for conventional oil and gas, and it's clearly a transitional technology. But it's made an enormous difference in the U.S. over the last 10 years.
Oh, no doubt.
So.
No doubt yeah about it. And, you know, it's highly controversial, of course, because, people are concerned about, from a few different angles. Does it do these fracking chemicals? Do they end up polluting our aquifers? Are we actually releasing more methane into the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas? Are we encouraging more and longer term dependence on oil and gas as opposed to moving to cleaner alternatives? Because as the supply increases and the
right
price comes down, there is not as much of an incentive for people economically, at least from the standpoint of the consumer's immediate interest in dollars flowing out of their weekly household budget. Yeah, there's not a lot of incentive to think about doing other types of things besides putting, gas in the tank. And
have you ever noticed at any time a lot of interest begins to grow on renewables and breakthrough energy, suddenly, boom, the price goes down?
It is kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is kind of interesting. Well, I know it's very... Yeah. So I want to know emotionally... You go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you want to just kind of touch it on that, what you just stated. Bill Gates has been briefed on cold fusion very, very deeply, at least at a fairly recent, I believe, a December meeting in Italy. He was thoroughly briefed on what's called, the preferred name for cold fusion is low energy nuclear reactions, or LENR. And there are some credible sources that say that Gates is now funding cold fusion to some, in some capacity. is there something going on? Well,
that's the big question is that, because for a long time I believed that there is a line between the general economy and this technology, and that line's been kept. This technology has been kept out of the general economy for many decades. Where the energy technology we use in the mainstream economy is decades, if not centuries, old.
Right.
And and essentially all innovation development has been kept off on the side. Now, I believe this stuff exists because if you look at the UFOs and you look at the underground bases, I just don't see a way to run all of those underground bases on fossil fuels.
No.
So my opinion is,
yeah.
Right, the breakaways are using this stuff on the planet, whether they're flying around in the sky or they're, you know, building cities underground. So somebody's using it, somebody's got it, although I don't know specifically what it is. But it's not, you know, I mean, if you've ever seen those UFOs, they're not flying, they're not, you know, they're not gassing up at Exxon, that's for sure.
No, no.
So somebody's got it.
Yeah, and the simple fact is, if there has been even one of the claims of contact being credible, if even one, all right, it automatically implies there are advanced energy and propulsion technologies. And
right.
They are here. Okay.
Right.
So it would mean that it's possible. It would mean that scientists, you know, crouching and cringing behind some dogmatic position about what is and is not possible in energy science loses all its credibility because someone else is already doing it. Okay. Now they may be a very, very distant cousin to us. All right. But they're there and they've figured it out. Now, I personally believe
right.
that the universe is highly populated and that there is a lot of interstellar commerce and leisure travel, and that quite a bit of it happens to come into our neighborhood. So I accept these things as kind of matter of fact. I've had my family and I have had our own direct personal experiences in that area that just kind of make it very matter of fact. So,
right.
You know, I just think that we just kind of like, okay, let's get over it, folks. And let's start understanding and sharing these opportunities to do some incredibly happy and important work on our planet. Because we can change the whole game. And it'd be just wonderful.
Things can work.
What an adventure.
Things can work.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Poverty is a political choice. It's not an economic necessity.
Hmm.
There's no reason for poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so I, what was I going to, oh, so here's my question for you, Joel. Emotionally, how do you maintain your calm, you maintain and have a happy life and a family and do all these things, holding in your mind the extraordinary contradiction between the way we as a planet do things, which is very primitive, and what you know is possible? How do you manage to navigate a very primitive world, knowing what you know and yet having a wonderful life? How do you do it?
Okay, I just got to tell you right now, I am getting literally goosebumps all over my body. I'm serious. And I think because what I need to say next is probably the most important thing that I could possibly say. And that is, I know in my being that there's something that I'm supposed to be part of to help us get to that healthier, happier world. And I accept that call, and I want to do it. And it's really the happiest thing that I experience in my life right now is doing it. And usually how it comes about is meeting people, collaborating with people, having small glimpses at what's possible, because I have seen some amazing things. I guess you could say that I've seen behind the wizard's curtain a number of times. I know these things are real, but even if I hadn't had the experiences of seeing and touching some of these amazing technologies and other experiences, I know in my heart and in my soul that there is a a greater intelligence that does understand the workings of this world and the rest, that also is very, very conscious of the role that each of us can play in turning this into a beautiful adventure. We don't have to be totally consumed by the apparent work that we do to feed our families. And I do it. You know, I have a regular day job and all that kind of thing. And then I run New Energy Movement as my philanthropy of sorts. And then I meet with all these various inventors and try to, you know, get involved in these other projects that, you know, some of which you know about and all that. But it's fabulous. There's many nights I don't want to sleep because I feel like I'm going to miss something. But it's more about you know, kind of dealing with the fact that, you know, there's still a physical organism that we move around in, and it is vulnerable to fatigue, unfortunately, at least in this stage of our evolution. And I'd like to
be- Yeah, we haven't found that breakthrough energy that we can plug into.
Exactly. So I think that's a kind of long-winded answer to the emotional balance issue. Is that, look, I'm a scientist who believes in a loving creator and a benevolent universe. It's not even just a belief. It's a knowing. It's the most certain thing that I am aware of. And right. So that is what I appeal to that greater something every day. Generally at the start of my day, I think about it throughout the day, and at the end of the day, it is the most real thing to me. And so I just try to listen and just, you know, go where I'm pointed and work with the people who are put in my path, who I look at as being deliberately sent to me to work with me, that we each have messages to give and receive in each moment. And just be open to that and watch the miracles happen. And they do. They literally.
They do. They do.
They do. Yeah. Yeah.
I live in a town called Hickory Valley, and there's a town mural painted up on one of the buildings across the town commons from me. And underneath is a quote from Corinthians, which is kind of the town motto that says, whatever you do, do it for the glory of God.
Amen.
There you go.
Well, you can't go wrong there. You know, I think, you know, when I hear scientists, and some of them are some of the most brilliant, and by brilliant, I mean some of the most intellectually gifted people that I've ever met, when I hear them be just dogmatically opposed to even the idea that there is a creator even, I just have to, my mouth almost just drops open. Like, how can you be so unaware?
Lost.
I really, the even the word for it, because how can you be so intellectually intelligent and so so ignorant in the spiritual capacity, which is another form of intelligence? And, you know, I kind of look at things, you know, and I'll tell, you know, so I'm a grandfather, right? In fact, my oldest daughter and my 7-year-old granddaughter just moved into my home here 3 weeks ago, which has been a great joy and a tremendous adjustment for all of us here. But I would say that as a grandfather, you know, I've seen a little bit of life and have had a few experiences. But, and one of the things I've come to see is that, you know, while there are many, many people who are very, very intellectually intelligent, including most every scientist you're likely to meet, it doesn't mean that what comes along with that is the social intelligence, the emotional intelligence, the spiritual intelligence, and then the good seasoning of experience, all of which have to combine to actually get some real wisdom. And I would posit that someone who is unaware of the source of life and the source of love and of universal sustenance. If they're unaware of that or uninterested in knowing that, I'm sorry, folks, but you cannot say that person has wisdom. They
right.
might have intelligence. They might have some good ideas here and there, but they don't have wisdom. And that's my bias.
Right. And the danger is they can then make a whole lot of mess. So I have two more questions before we close. Oil and gas prices. Do we think that the consciousness about breakthrough energy is now sufficient, or the actions? You know, we have a whole bunch of countries that are in a real squeeze. China and India are being squeezed by a growing population, growing middle class. Germany and Japan, huge squeeze. You know, Germany wants to not be dependent on Russian gas, but now they're closing down nuclear reactors because of Fukushima. And, of course, Japan's had Fukushima. So you've got some of the greatest engineering minds of the world who have enormous incentive to figure this out and start to apply it. So do you think we've reached the point where we're starting to see the line shift? Could this be affecting oil and gas prices?
Well, that is a good speculation. I, of course, can't say it for a certainty, but I do know that certainly in the case of Japan, they have some of the leading researchers in the cold fusion field. And I would tell, you know, the audience here, cold fusion is real, and it is becoming ever more refined and robust, and it's around the corner.
Right.
And these countries, like you said, I mean, there's a lot of great science acumen in both, you know, Germany and Japan. And they're not just sitting around building windmills.
No.
You know, that's not what they're doing. There's a lot of other things, you know, in the works. And I think.
Well, I almost fell over when Lockheed came out with their announcement.
Yeah, it was kind of a curious announcement about their fusion, you know, speaking of a fusion technology. I didn't find a lot of substance.
There was no substance in it.
Yeah.
I assume they were doing it to sort of checkmate what the Russians had just made an announcement, and so Lockheed made an announcement to kind of check and checkmate.
Oh,
I thought it must...
The Russians have a very robust breakthrough energy science community over there. They're
right.
doing some of the best work, and they're doing some things with plasma technologies, with magnetic platforms for energy that are, well, look very, very promising.
Well, you know, they really are the dominant player in the palladium market. And I keep watching as gold and silver have come down. Palladium hasn't come down anywhere near as much. And I keep wondering, yeah, that's what I keep thinking.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Does this have anything to do with cold fusion?
Well,
now, who knows?
It could possibly, but the more kind of like the leading... the leading horses in the cold fusion race aren't using palladium
okay.
anymore. The electrolytic types of the cold fusion process, you know, do still use those type of precious metals as a catalyst or as an electrode. But what's more predominant now are processes that are using powdered nickel,
mm-hmm.
and that are using a solid fuel form of hydrogen. It's generally it's like lithium aluminum hydride, which is it's a solid material that when you heat it up, it eventually at a certain temperature it releases hydrogen into the process, and then hydrogen has some type of interaction with the nickel. In a process that is highly speculated, but not well understood. There are lots of theories about it, but seems to be very, very repeatable in producing excess heat. And the most recent replications and verifications of these type of nickel hydrogen fusion processes are showing about an excess heat output of about 3 times as much on the output side of the process as on the inside of the process. And that's huge. I mean, to think about that, a three to one over unity process.
That's amazing.
Those results are fairly consistent between various researchers, and there's a lot of activity that's happened in the last 6 months in that field, and you know, even up to this past week, there's been some very interesting developments there. So it's very fertile, and I think that you know, what we're likely to see is that there will be some of these you know, low energy nuclear reaction, LENR, aka cold fusion, type of processes that are likely to come into the industrial and commercial space probably within the next maybe 2 to 3 years. Then probably you know, into maybe the transportation space, possibly, you know, 5 to 6 years. And then last will be at the consumer front, before you actually would have a device for the home. And there's good reasons for that. It's much more practical for an inventor, or, you know, a new company that has a breakthrough energy process to have that process marshaled along by a commercial entity or industrial entity that not only has a facility of scale where they can really have the process engaged round the clock, producing usable power, and have a technical staff there that can be there to maintain and troubleshoot, and you're isolating your first number of these installed units or devices. You're isolating those in a few locations, which minimizes the risk during the early phase learnings and all this. Because, you know, a company can sustain an accident and kind of contain that and pay for that in ways that the individual homeowner can't. Now, you
right.
can see how if someone had a cold fusion type of device in their home, something goes awry, starts a fire, burns down the home, family gets injured. Well, guess what that's going to do? That would put such a kibosh on this whole field, and it would be used to great effect by those who wouldn't want the technology to proliferate. You know, they'd have all the scare tactics going and that whole thing. Whereas if instead you had it in a much more managed setting at a professional, you know, installation with trained personnel and all that, you just minimize the risk. So it's just no doubt in my mind these energy systems are going to be deployed first at commercial, industrial, then likely in the transportation sector, then the last will be the consumer front.
Right. You need a professional overhead to really manage it.
Yep.
Okay, last question. You joined us at the Secret Space Program Conference.
Oh.
And I'm always trying to make sure that that our subscribers watch those videos. We have them up on the subscriber only space. So they're all accessible, and I always say to them, watch Farrell, Fitz, Dolan, and Farrell, and McCandlish. Just go through them all. But I want you to describe what the impact was on you of being there and hearing all the different presentations, and just share with everybody what it was like for you. And I have to say, before, I was shocked that it had such an impact on you, because I said, Joel, you know all of this already. Why would this have an impact?
Okay, so I will preface it with this, all right? Several of the leading UFO ET researchers are friends of mine and have been long-time friends of mine, and I've been exposed to this field for quite some time. And I've been to a lot of conferences and gatherings where these topics have been presented in various ways. Without just with no question at all, that Secret Space Conference had the most high quality, best articulated, and most professionally presented cases of evidence and theory and implications of anything that I'd seen before. It was so well orchestrated as far as how these things these topics all were interwoven in something that finally painted a really coherent picture of the broader field and what its impact is on the everyday citizen. And I would say that someone could come in to that could have come into that conference who was just like a regular Joe or Mary off the street who knew nothing about the topic, and they could hear this and they would have come to grasp to a very high level what the meaning of this topic was, the fact that it's real and serious and affects them, as could a very highly educated academic from any of our major universities could be there and feel very comfortable that these are professionals who are delivering these presentations, who know their stuff, and who could argue these points and present facts in a way that could withstand very, very vigorous scrutiny. And to me, that whole balance of speaking to the whole spectrum with credibility was something I hadn't seen anywhere else. Oftentimes, these other conferences I've been at, there's kind of some of the angle that gets discussed in a way or presented in a way that leads it so open for criticism, ridicule, and deservedly so in a lot of cases. But that did not happen at the Secret Space Conference. And for me personally, to hear Joseph Farrell finally, to actually hear him, especially hear him in person, was a great treat.
It's terrific.
Yeah, just such a amazing stuff. You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, so I can't recommend it enough.
Okay, well, you heard it from the source. Got to watch those conference videos. They're really, I just think they snap into the jigsaw puzzle a piece that really helps you get the whole picture.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they do. Okay, well, Joel, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Slayer Report. Just describe your website. If we want to support your efforts to build this standards group, what do we do? How do we do it?
Best way is to go to newenergymovement.org. And at newenergymovement.org on the homepage, you can see a number of different resources to find out more about what the Standards and Testing Protocol Initiative is about. There's the presentation that I gave on this at the Global Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Boulder last year. That's up there. You can watch it. There's some other presentation videos up there as well. What is not up there yet is basically a collaboration that just came about between New Energy Movement and the Tesla Science Foundation to join together in moving this initiative forward. So the Tesla Science Foundation, who I highly respect, they have agreed to really help find some sponsors for
that's this. Fantastic.
So that we can finally have have some money to pay the technical committee members who would actually write the protocols. What we have found is that there's a lot of people who believe this is a really great idea, but they don't have or not willing to commit the time to do it for free. And I understand that because I have served as a volunteer on protocol development committees for the water treatment field, both in the U.S. and Canada. And it does take a lot of time.
It's very time consuming.
But you know, this is a very worthy initiative. Your listeners can certainly go check it out. We're happy to accept any type of support you'd bring our way, including financial. And there's easy ways to do that, you know, at the website. And I really appreciate you taking a look.
Okay. Okay. Well, Joe, you have a wonderful week. And if you see that line between the between the labs and the real economy melting. Give me a call. I need to know.
Okay, Catherine.
Have a great
Okay. Take care.
Bye. Bye.